something I think that doesn't destroy the American state, and that's my greatest concern. That's why I said you've got to intervene to save Israel from itself, because Israel and God is on the path to Armageddon.
How do we save Israel from
itself?
Joe Biden pull up Bibi Netanyahu and say you can't do this.
Recording is not recording.
Ja, das jetzt, hörst du mich?
Ja.
Sehr gut.
To destroy Hamas. I don't know if anybody disagrees with that. I certainly don't. I'm 100% behind whatever can be done to destroy Hamas.
The only person that apparently disagrees with that is the President Erdogan, who thinks they're a liberation organization.
Well, a couple of days ago, he took a different position. Now, suddenly, they become holy warriors defending their ground, which I think is very scary, because that makes it very clear that he has unambiguously aligned himself now with the opponents of Israel. He had not done that before. But I think it takes a president who has the authority and the strength to tell the Israeli government, no, you cannot go into Gaza and execute the plans that you currently have. Now, we've had this before. Richard Nixon made abundantly clear that we would not tolerate an Israeli presence on the Egyptian side of the Suez Canal. And some of you may remember that the Israelis crossed that canal, and then were withdrawn back to the other side. It eventually produced a very good agreement between Egypt and Israel. And of course, right. You know, that's another concern. Why would you want to put that at risk right now? The Egyptians have tried very hard to work with Israel. In fact, we know that the Egyptian general and military intelligence alerted the Israelis to the possibility of this Hamas attack. At least that's the public record says that. So that's another problem.
You know, muss ich machen?
Jetzt ist es gut, oder? Einfach noch, die Kamera läuft, das ist perfekt. Einfach noch ein kurzes Intro, kannst du irgendwann kurz machen, dann hast du noch
immer... Das ist ein anderer Bildschnitt als sonst.
Ja, es ist, ich kann noch ein Vollbild machen.
Das ist komisch jetzt.
Israel has a barrier. Egypt doesn't want war with Israel, but how do you
keep the power
under the circumstances? I think that's the same thing for Jordan. I mean, the king of Jordan has done the same thing, tried to cultivate a good and positive
relationship with Israel.
But they all say the same thing. Collective punishment
is not a point of
Israeli security.
That's the problem.
So you've got to have a president.
Irgendwie haben wir die Kameraeinstellung jetzt verändert.
Ich habe ihn gemacht.
Komisch, weißt du, ich habe sonst nie das. Musst mal schauen da. Ich habe nicht das Ding drauf.
Musst
mal schauen da.
Pull back, we'll reconsider what our options are, what can be done, then we'll remain and continue to support you. That's a tough thing for him to do, given the power and influence.
Aha, doch, Balasche. Ja, doch, es ist ungefähr, das ist doch etwas. Ja, es geht doch etwas.
Ich muss einfach unbedingt in die Mitte sitzen und noch eine Maschineleitung.
Also was ist Mitte? So sitze ich da, oder so sitze ich?
So, dass du vielleicht zentriert bist.
Nein, das geht nicht, weil dann habe ich da so ein weißes Loch, das ist scheiße. Ich sitze immer so. Wo ist er da, oder? Danke,
super.
Ja.
Ich würde auch, bevor er kommt, glaube ich, noch ein Intro machen, also eine Einleitung.
Ich glaube, ich mache das gerade wieder Dings. Ich würde gerade sagen, es sind da wieder Dings. Weißt du, wie da der Judging Freedom?
War had broken out and we were
going to
destroy Iran. And there's been this obsession, this fixation with the annihilation of Iran. Now seems to be the moment that the neocons, globalists, and so forth have chosen to attack Iran. And they're in a full court press, as I think I mentioned. Former Senator Joseph Lieberman has been on beating the drums for essentially the same thing, although he talked about targeted missile attacks or something, which of course is ridiculous. Once you go to war, you go to war. And there are no holds barred. So the notion that you're going to attack two or three targets and you don't get a full-scale war is absurd.
Is there a propaganda campaign in the West designed to push the Biden administration toward war with Iran, led by people like Senator Graham and former Senator Lieberman?
Of course, you know, but this has been ongoing. This is not new. All of these people have expressed this wish repeatedly for years. They simply think that now they have the opportunity to finally unleash it. They think they've got an administration that they can manipulate, that they can push and bully into action. And indeed, they don't really have to bully. They've got plenty of people inside the Biden cabinet that are absolutely hard over to attack Iran. And this obsession with attacking Iran obscures the other things that are going on in the region, as we've discussed. You attack Iran, that's going to do you a lot of good when you've got 250,000 Turkish troops moving through Syria to engage the Israelis on the Golan Heights. And this is what nobody's thinking about. What happens when the Turkish forces at sea attack our forces at sea? And by the way, remember that we're not really moving our forces into the Eastern Mediterranean at this point because they'd be at risk of attack from a whole range of weapon systems that are ashore. So at the moment, the safest place for the carrier battle group is somewhere in the vicinity of Sicily. And that's a long flight in a jet carrying ordnance to drop on top of Hezbollah. And of course, everything hinges on Hezbollah. In other words, the assumption is, and I think it's an accurate one, that if the Israelis strike decisively into Gaza with whatever size force they develop, they're going to get a two-front war. And Hezbollah is going to take the gloves off and launch its 100,000+ missiles and rockets into Israel. So then you're dealing with other actors, Syria, Turkey, Iran, and obviously Russia. Russia is not going to sit idly by and watch Iran be destroyed. And Russia will be disinterested in going to war with us, but certainly doesn't want a war with Israel. Russia's been very accommodating to Israeli interests, but remember the Israelis have helped in Ukraine to kill
troops.
They've provided a lot of intelligence. They've had a lot of Assad officers in the country.
Colonel, can you hear me?
Yes, I'm surprised you're listening to me in the background.
Yeah, I'm just listening to your interview with Judge Andrew Napolitano.
Uh-huh. So how have you been?
Well, very good. It's quite some exciting times. It's absurd what's happening. It's piling up one problem after the other.
It's hard to believe.
It's amazing. Yeah. But it's great. I just heard your interview also with Tucker Carlson. Very interesting. We had him too. It was interesting where he said that the American government prevented him from interviewing Putin, which was taken up in the Kremlin. I've heard that they had to comment on that. No, it's great to have you back on this program. How are you? Everything okay? Everything good?
Yeah, I just had some dental surgery.
Oh,
my least favorite event.
Oh my goodness. Well, at least they can. Well, I had once. They had a very severe thing here, and they couldn't do the anesthetics. You know, it didn't work. So it was like in the Middle Ages. It was really terrible.
Oh my God! Yeah,
it's great. It's better. I would say just to go through to the. I would say first we start, but very short, on just a little update on the Ukraine war, because this has completely disappeared somehow from the headlines.
Yes.
Just to bring us there. And then, of course, I would go a bit through this whole Middle East mess. And it would be interesting also to have your comments a bit on, you know, the 7th October. How do you see what happened there exactly? What was the message of Hamas? What do they want to achieve? What would you say? What kind of enemy is Hamas? And how you judge, of course, the reaction of Israel, and then all the escalation scenarios you have discussed with Tucker and Judge Napolitano.
Is this a 6-hour interview?
No, I would say no. We're walking through this in a very efficient, efficient way. So if you're ready, then I would say I will just turn off all my stuff here that we cannot get disturbed, and I would say we can just start it off.
Sounds good.
Very good. So I will do the same as. Judge Napolitano does. I will do the introduction while you are already on the program. I will do that in German and switch then to English.
Sure.
Okay, good. Gut. Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren, liebe Freunde aus nah und fern, von wo aus auch immer Sie uns zuschauen mögen. Ich begrüße Sie zu dieser Sondersendung von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht, unabhängig. Let's do it again, I don't do the... I don't want to make a misspell here. I just do it like my 30, I just did a 30-minute time break, but if we take more time, it's no problem, but just for me okay. Grüezi miteinander, ganz herzlich willkommen und einen wunderschönen guten Tag, meine sehr verehrten Damen und Herren. Ich freue mich, Sie zu begrüßen zu einer weiteren Sondersendung von Weltwoche Daily, die andere Sicht, unabhängig, kritisch, zuversichtlich, am Donnerstag, dem 26. Oktober 2023. Und es ist eine große Freude, wieder begrüßen zu dürfen den Ihnen bereits bestens vertrauten Colonel Douglas MacGregor. Und ich werde jetzt auf Englisch weiterfahren, weil unser Gast bereits im Programm wartet. Und es ist unhöflich, wenn ich da in einer Fremdsprache weiterspreche. Colonel, it's great to have you back here at Weltwoche Daily. How have you been? Everything okay in the United States?
Yes, well, I must admit that listening to your Schweizdeutsch is a little difficult. So it's a good thing we're speaking English, because I've only gotten every third word or so.
Well, I mean, this is absolutely depressing for me, what you have just said now, because I tried to use my best high German, which has been identified by US Swiss German. So I'm already annihilated at the beginning of our program.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I remember in school having to learn a little bit of Schweizdeutsch. You know, it was Über allen Gipfeln ist Ruhe, very famous in German.
Yes.
Über allen echt gürst nüt, something like that, you know. So it was might as well have spoken Greek, you know.
This is actually one of our secrets to preserve our dialect in order to scare off the Germans. But please don't tell it to the Germans.
Well, they're easily scared these days. So.
Yeah, I mean, what's your relationship to Switzerland, by the way? You've ever been to Switzerland? You know the country a little bit?
Just a little bit. I visited Luzern and drove through the country. This is 1978. That's my last real visit to Switzerland. So I would like to have seen more, but I didn't have much time. I was a young lieutenant serving in Germany.
Okay.
So I didn't have much time.
Well, these were the glorious old days. Switzerland has changed a lot, not always to the better. Well, let's start it off here. Let's begin before we switch to the Middle East. Let's talk a bit first, an update on the Ukraine war. It has disappeared from the headlines. Interestingly enough, I mean, the media do not write much about Ukraine anymore. Can you give us a short update of what's happening in the Ukraine right now?
Well, I think it's somewhat beneficial to Washington that it has managed to redirect media attention to Israel, because things have gone very badly for Washington and obviously its puppet regime in Kiev. And right now, the Russians have moved forward, but at a very deliberate pace, seeking to avoid any casualties. They're making significant progress near Avdiivka, I think is the name of the town that... has turned into something of a Bakhmut for the Ukrainian forces that are there. At the same time, they're moving north and west, I think with the objective of surrounding and taking Kharkov in the next days or weeks. All of this is being very carefully orchestrated, deliberately done. There are no mad dashes forward. And again, someone asked me, well, why hasn't Putin and the Russian military overwhelmed all of Ukraine? You keep saying they can do it. Well, obviously they can do it, but there are no hurry to try and govern large numbers of Ukrainians. The areas that they sit in are historically Russian. And as far as the Russians are concerned, those areas from Odessa to Kharkov should be Russian again, but they're not particularly enthusiastic about governing tough-minded Ukrainians that want nothing to do with Russia. Mm-hmm. What Moscow wants is a settlement, an end to this thing. And we, of course, are standing in the way. So the question is, what happens in Europe? When do European governments come to their senses and put an end to this tragedy in Ukraine? But as far as the Americans are concerned, they're sending more money. But I think that's simply designed to keep this regime on life support, at least until the election, to maintain the facade that there is some element of legitimacy to it and some measure of success when there has been none.
Do you see light at the end of the tunnel as far as Ukraine is concerned? Are we any step closer to an agreement due to the fact that militarily the facts are speaking more clearly every day?
Not really, not in Washington. And I've said this many times. Europeans need to understand that Washington cannot end this conflict. First of all, why would Moscow believe anything we said? Why would they trust anything that we signed on to? I think this is really a matter for the states that border Russia and Ukraine, and particularly the Central East European countries. Berlin, Budapest, Warsaw, they can play a very important role in bringing this tragedy to an end. I think Paris, to some extent, can contribute, but I don't see London being any more credible than we are, given their behavior. So it's a matter of the people that live closest to this have to come to terms with the reality that this cannot go on if they want a Ukraine to exist at all. We think that half the population of Ukraine is either dead or left, moved out of the country. What kind of future does Ukraine have under these circumstances? If it's to have any future at all, it needs to end.
Is the United States government losing interest in Ukraine? Are we seeing a scenario as we have witnessed in Afghanistan, where you could say in the middle of the night, the Americans ran off and just left Afghanistan? Do you see any signs that the United States have this kind of Saigon, Afghanistan scenario at the moment?
Yes, and I've tried to remind people repeatedly that we and the British are quite similar in that we are primarily aerospace and maritime powers. When things don't go our way, when our mistakes have been made, we simply fly and sail away. And someone asked, what would happen in Ukraine? I said this months ago. I said, eventually it will end up like Vietnam. We'll simply leave. We'll change the subject. And remember, most Americans pay remarkably little attention to what happens beyond their borders. This is a huge problem for us. But a Spanish general staff officer once said to me when I was at Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe, said, Colonel McGregor, the United States is not a country. It's not a nation. It's a planet. You live on it. And he was absolutely correct. And this is what gets us into trouble, because Americans are concerned with what happens in their own country, which means a small, well-financed elite in Washington can steer the ship of state pretty much any direction it wants to go. And most Americans don't want anything to do with these wars or interventions or conflicts. They're happy to cheer at the beginning. They rapidly lose interest, and it's left in the hands of this small ruling elite to decide what to do. This really needs to stop in our country. But stopping it is not an easy thing to do. We've been doing this sort of thing for, 70, 80 years, since the end of the Second World War.
Very important what you're saying, and especially for our audience and even some politicians who are watching this program, because probably in Europe, not many people are really aware of the fact that at the end of the day, they have to go for a settlement, that they cannot rely on the Americans solely. But let's move now on to another sphere of conflict, which has almost been a little bit forgotten, the Middle East. I mean, a very tense situation at the moment. Let's walk through the events. I would be very curious to hear your analysis. Let's go back to October 7th, this heinous attack from these Hamas terrorists. From your military experience, what exactly happened on this day? Was this a terrorist attack on a new scale, something we haven't witnessed before? To me, it felt like a horror movie in reality, but you are a much more hard-boiled personality than I am. What does a military expert with your Tonnage, with your expertise, say what happened on the 7th of October?
Well, I should point out that I was in Israel 3 years ago in February of 2020, and I had the opportunity, because I was a guest of the IDF chief of staff, to visit the Gaza front, so to say. So I saw the barriers, I saw the walls, I saw how the Israelis had constructed what I thought was a very effective and tightly organized security system. To be perfectly blunt with you, I'm somewhat surprised by the entire thing. It seems almost incomprehensible to me that the Hamas fighters could have broken through as suddenly and as easily as they did without two things. One is shameless incompetence, for which I saw no evidence when I was in Israel, or someone deliberately let them in. It's just hard for me to believe that Hamas was quite that clever, because it's very difficult in this very small area. It's only 140 square miles. The Israelis really understood what was happening inside of it. And of course, you had the Egyptians on the other side, equally concerned about what Hamas could do and its potential to destabilize the region, also providing information and intelligence to the Israelis. So I think the Israelis at some point will have to launch an investigation. In 73, you had a different situation, but a similar outcome. And ultimately, Golda Meir, with a few other senior officers, was held responsible and accountable for what had happened in 1973. Because once again, there were plenty of indicators that something was happening, and they should have prepared more effectively for it. So now the Hamas breaks through. There were 3,000 fighters. They came in several waves. 1,500 of them were eventually killed. The others escaped back into Gaza. But that's the tip of the proverbial iceberg. We think there may be 50 to 60,000 heavily armed Hamas fighters. Mm-hmm. And in some respects, if we really believe that Hamas was able to pull this off without being noticed and broke through as easily as they did, I'm beginning to think that they have set a trap for the Israeli Defense Force. In other words, let the Israeli Defense Force move into Gaza. And since the Israelis have rubbled the place, which means that you have ruins as opposed to buildings and so forth, it's much easier for the defender now than it would have been to defend a normal city. And of course, this was the experience during World War II. We found the same problem. The Germans did. The Soviets did. You didn't want to destroy the city. If you did that, the defense was infinitely more powerful than the offense. Mm. So I now think that Israel has embarked on a war of annihilation directed at Gaza. That's the best way that I can put it. And of course, many of the acts that were performed by Hamas, which were heinous and atrocious, certainly helped to sort of inspire the Israelis to a higher level of vengeance. But the bad news here is that once again, everyone is being guided. When I say everyone, I'm talking about the Israeli government, people in Washington, by emotion as opposed to reason. There's no one sitting there and saying, well, does it make sense for us to go into Gaza at all under the circumstances? Is there not another way to do this? It's a kind of bloodlust that's hard to suppress. It's similar to the attitudes in the United States towards Japan after the Pearl Harbor. So at this point, though, I think the Israelis are confronted with a very difficult situation. As you know, they sent in a small reconnaissance element in search of some hostages, and that small reconnaissance element that consisted allegedly of both U.S. and Israeli special forces was attacked and driven off with casualties. So I think the Hamas fighters are absolutely waiting and quite prepared for what's to come next, and it will be a fight to the finish.
What would you say, what kind of enemy is Hamas? I'm not an expert in Middle East warfare. I just remember 20 years ago, we published in Weltwoche, we published the founding charter of Hamas, which was to me highly disturbing, because you could read that this group is about to annihilate the Jews. I mean, they're not just talking about Israel. They say you have to kill the Jews wherever you find them. You have to destroy Israel. So it seems to me an organization which is almost motivated by biblical hate against Israel. But what do you make of this Hamas? I see that also in Switzerland, in Germany, people are sometimes not so clear about what Hamas is. Now, President Erdogan said it's a liberation group. What is Hamas in your military perspective?
Well, setting aside very briefly the military dimension, Hamas appears to be an offshoot of the Muslim Brotherhood. You could describe it as the armed wing of the Muslim Brotherhood. Muslim Brotherhood, of course, aspires to take over and Islamicize the world, but it plans to do that, quote unquote, peacefully, even through democratic means. In other words, if you can breed enough Muslims in Europe, then eventually you can make Europe an extension of the Islamic world, as opposed to outright violence. Hamas is the violent wing of it and is dedicated to the destruction of Israel without question and any Jews who remain there. But, you know, I don't think we should compare it to ISIS, which was a wholly different animal and ultimately founded preeminently to destroy Shia and the Shiites in the region. It then began killing everyone in sight, but the truth was that was the original objective. This is solely focused on Israel and its elimination. And that's one of the reasons why we're looking at a war of annihilation being waged by the Israelis against it. And of course, the sad part is that in this setting, there are no real non-combatants from the vantage point of the Israelis. If you're there, you're an enemy. And we ought to stop and consider that if you go back to Stalingrad, there are 2 to 3 times as many civilians in northern Gaza as there were in Stalingrad when the fighting there began. And it was not a war of extermination in Stalingrad. We, you know, that's misleading. It was a terrible, terrible event, and a million Soviet casualties resulted. But this is worse, to be blunt. This is wholesale murder. And this is upsetting the Islamic world. Because remember, Mr. Erdogan spoke quite recently. He is the head of the Muslim Brotherhood. He actually heads the Muslim Brotherhood in North America. So you've now stirred a different pot, if you will. This is a very different event from what we've seen elsewhere in the Middle East. And it is inciting all Muslims, Shiites and Sunni together. And I would never have believed that you might have seen a Turkish-Iranian alliance against Israel, because those are the two historic rivals in the region. Yet that's exactly what is emerging. Mm-hmm.
Where is the responsibility of Prime Minister Netanyahu? There are critics who say his government and his ruthless style against Gaza and against the Palestinians, this ruthless style has somehow created this monster of Gaza, has somehow created also this terrorist attack. So it's the product of a misguided extremist Israel policy in the Middle East. What do you make of this argument?
It's not invalid, but it's more complex. During the Camp David Accord discussions, before the accords were signed, and Sadat of Egypt met with Begin of Israel, Begin actually offered Sadat Gaza and said, please, take it. Take it off our hands. We don't want it. And Sadat said, not on your life, because we don't want this destabilizing element in our own country. Plus the fact the Egyptians, as we know, are trying to maintain millions and millions and millions, tens of millions of people on an infrastructure built for a fraction of that number. So more is something they can't cope with easily anyway. So I don't think this is new. What happens, I think, over the last 20 years, people have referred to Gaza as becoming the largest open-air concentration camp in the world. Well, that may be extreme, but it's not entirely inaccurate. So it's a combination of things, an insoluble problem for the Israelis, a problem that their neighbors have not wanted to solve, and the outcome is combustion, explosion, and a more radicalized element than perhaps anyone ever anticipated would emerge, particularly since it's turned out to be quite competent.
Mm-hmm. And how do you judge now the military and the political reaction of Benjamin Netanyahu? I've heard you saying in another interview that Prime Minister Netanyahu is in a way embarking on a mission of self-destruction with his way of addressing this problem with this war now against Gaza. Could you elaborate on that? How do you interpret, how do you judge the reaction of the Israeli in this moment? Do they have a plan? Do they know what they are doing? What's your impression?
Well, the plan is to level as much of Gaza as possible and then go in and root out the enemy. Of course, the problem is who's the enemy? And that's where you run into the difficulty of separating so-called non-combatants from combatants. And that's not going to happen. People that are staying there now who are not members of Hamas or are not fighters are going to end up being killed. And I think there's something else happening with Netanyahu, who sees the criticality of revenge and leading this revenge campaign. He also has enormous power and influence in Washington, probably greater than ever in the history of Israel. And remember, Israel is another small state. Small states, when they're allied with large states, are always permanently interested in leveraging the power of the larger state in their behalf. Well, we have virtual control over events in Washington now, and Mr. Netanyahu can ask politely and get pretty much whatever he wants without question. The Congress is in his pocket, if you will. So America right now is prepared to do almost anything unconditionally for Israel. So I think his attitude is, I'll leverage this, leverage our own power, and we'll annihilate our enemies. Well, the problem is that if the enemy were only in Gaza, that would be doable, probably, even though it would be bloody and nasty. But you've got Hezbollah, and then you have the rest of the Muslim world in the Middle East, the Arab Middle East. You have Egypt, for instance, that fears a war. The Egyptians don't want a war. Neither does Jordan. Both of those states are very fragile. They're trying to hold difficult societies together. But they stand a very high probability of being dragged in. And then, of course, you have Syria, which is already split between spheres of influence, U.S., Russian, Turkish, Iranian. And then you have the Turks and the Iranians, as well as the Peninsular Arabs. They are all uniting now in their antipathy for Israel and their determination to punish it. That's the problem. And so there's not enough military power that we can apply on behalf of Israel to compensate for that danger, although I don't think Mr. Netanyahu believes that. And again, this is another failure. People tend to look at the Arab world as unchanged from 1973. 50 years ago, what happened? See, we triumphed. We were at a disadvantage. We came back and won. The Arab world today is very different. These societies are more coherent, more cohesive. New technologies have emerged, which confer far greater capability on them than they formerly had. And then, of course, you have the Turks and the Iranians. And both of those states are very powerful in their own right. The Turks, of course, have the largest army in NATO, large air forces, and the Turks have a long martial history. They're ferocious fighters. There's a lot of bitterness and antipathy for Israel in Turkey based on the killing of Turkish soldiers and civilians who tried to go in and provide Gaza with aid in the past. Mm-hmm. Then on top of that, of course, the Iranian problem. And the Israelis have sort of obsessed over Iran for years, utterly refusing any opportunity to talk or discuss anything. So here we are. We're now facing an insoluble problem. The entire region is united in its hatred and antipathy for Israel and its determination that if Israel does not halt its war of annihilation on Gaza, that they will all engage. That may not happen all at once, but eventually it will. And behind the curtain, of course, is Russia. And, you know, the Israelis made a terrible mistake with the Russians. The Russians have accommodated Israel repeatedly in Syria, and in the Middle East, they've had good relations, and the Israelis turned on Russia and supported Ukraine, sending Mossad over there, along with a lot of other equipment and aids, intelligence, ammunition. So Russia stands there and says, why should I help Israel? And of course, they have no reason to cooperate with us. So I would expect that at some point, Russia could easily be drawn into this as well. But again, it will not come in early. But it will come in at some point, particularly if we begin to fight with the Turks and the Iranians. Iran especially. Iran is effectively an ally of Russia. This is a terrible set of circumstances. And the analogy that I've used repeatedly, as I said, go back to 1914, and here's the British government that has never gone to war against a German-speaking country. It's had nothing but good relations with German-speaking people. And all of a sudden, it makes a decision to intervene in the war on behalf of its age-old enemy, France. If Britain had stayed out of the 1914 debacle, it would have simply been another European war. But when Britain entered it, it became a world war, because as Bismarck had warned years earlier, eventually we would be drawn in to rescue Britain, which is exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. So the point is, once we get into this as a co-belligerent, and I would argue we are effectively already one, mm-hmm. the potential for this war to rapidly widen and spread is that much greater. Mm-hmm.
What a dangerous situation. Before we talk about this showdown scenario of a possible World War III, I think we have to confront this option, of course, in this very difficult situation. Just a quick question on Hamas, the last question on Hamas. I mean, I think it's undisputed that, and the people also understand that you have to fight against this enemy. Israel has said, we want to destroy Hamas. You want to destroy Hamas? This sounds absolutely reasonable. Okay, they want to destroy Hamas. Now the question is, how do you do that? I mean, we see in Gaza that they obviously have used millions and billions of aid money to construct a very sophisticated tunnel system, which is even more sophisticated than what the Americans have witnessed in Vietnam, or what the Americans have witnessed in Iwo Jima, in these terrible, terrible island wars in the Pacific. I mean, how is it conceivable to fulfill this promise to Hamas, to destroy Hamas? Is it possible to destroy Hamas? What would you say if you were the field commander, if you were the chief commander of the Israeli army? What would you say to Bibi Netanyahu if you told you, okay, of course, general, destroy Hamas? Can it be destroyed? Can you say something about that?
I would say to civilian superiors that we can certainly go in and kill large numbers of people, but Hamas is more than 40 or 50 or 60,000 fighters. It's an idea. You want to kill the idea. You want to discredit it. You're going to have a lot of trouble relying exclusively on military power for that purpose. So you might want to consider looking at other things that could be done that would rob Hamas of its argument. Now, that's not easy. But if you plan to maintain the state of Israel in this region, that's something you have to think about. Historically, the Israelis were instrumental in helping Hamas come into existence because they were very good at manipulating various factions in the Islamic world against each other. And that worked to advantage. Anytime there was a dispute anywhere or a conflict, the Israelis would involve itself with one or both sides. This is an entirely different set of circumstances, as we point out. Now, Hamas seems to be enjoying increasingly not just celebrity within a small area, but the support of the entire Islamic world. People from Indonesia to Morocco are involved now. So it's an idea. Killing ideas is very difficult. Killing people is easy. And you're never going to kill everyone, which means you're going to breed more opponents down the line. Unless you can line everyone up, all 2.2 million, and gun them down, you're going to get new generations of fighters. That's the problem. So the Israelis have to have a two-pronged approach, so to say. On the one hand, yes, we're going to go in, we're going to inflict damage, we're going to try and undermine it. You talked about tunnels. We used flamethrowers, particularly in the Pacific. I would expect the Israelis to use some fuel air explosive, which is a vapor that ignites and then explodes, robs everything of oxygen, destroys everything. I would expect that to happen in some of these tunnels if they can make it work. In other words, this is a no-holds-bar operation. But if you think that will be the end of it, you're making a mistake. And that's why I would warn the civilian authorities, what have you got in your back pocket in terms of a strategy to deal with the profoundly human dimension of this? What are you going to do? And that would, I think, cause any thoughtful person to back away from wholesale extermination.
I mean, this is it's amazing what you are describing. My impression is, if I look at the pictures now of the warfare of Israel, if I talk to our correspondent in Tel Aviv, who I would say he basically supports the Israel answer, but he says these are very disturbing images we see from Gaza. So if I understand you correctly, what is Israel doing right now is not actually destroying Hamas, but it is even making this monster bigger, and it like if puts another, I mean, other people will support Hamas because they see, because they see what Israel is doing. Is Israel at the moment acting against its own interest with this kind of warfare?
I think so, and I think there are many Israelis who understand this, but they have no voice in the government. And I doubt seriously that their views are being heard by anyone in power. You're listening to the Netanyahu wing of Israeli politics that is out for blood and feels strongly that it has to administer this object lesson or Israel won't survive, as opposed to what I am suggesting, which is if you administer the object lesson, Israel will not survive. Mm-hmm. That's my argument. And so I've said to people that would listen here in Washington, every president at some point has intervened in these conflicts involving Israel. He's operated usually as a check on Israeli power. In other words, the Israelis crossed the Suez Canal. We said no after the counterattacks to break through the Egyptian lines. We said, no, we don't want that. Pull back to the other side of the Suez. Then we got a ceasefire. And as a result, we got an agreement, which was a very good agreement in the long run between Egypt and Israel. Right now, there is no check on Israeli power. There is no check on power from the United States being employed on Israel's behalf. I think a president today is really obligated to save Israel from itself if Israel is to survive. My great fear is that that won't happen. The entire region will line up against it, and nothing we do is going to save Israel at that point.
You mentioned before the First World War. This is highly interesting, the long road to the First World War. But I would say there was an interesting nuance or a difference that if you look at the politics in the beginning of the 20th century, my impression from what I've read, many of the superpowers of the day thought that they will actually prevail in this war and they can get something out of it. Everybody had some kind of interest in going into war and completely misjudging the situation. They thought at the end of it, we will win. Surely the Germans thought they will win, the British thought they will win, the French thought together with the Russians they will win. And isn't it so today that nobody wants a global war? Nobody wants to risk a global war, be it Russia, be it China, be it the United States, even though they seem to have a severe leadership problem in Washington at the moment. So isn't this a common interest of the superpowers of today an argument which says we shouldn't panic at the moment? The scenario of a World War III in the Middle East starting there is not so big. What do you say? Are you concerned that a Third World War could emerge from this situation?
Well, I haven't used a World War III as a term. I just haven't, because I think that if we're exposed to even a fraction of what you're describing, people will be shocked and will reel back in fear of it. Now, the good news is that at least in Moscow, with President Putin and certainly with President Xi in China, you're talking about two men who have been in political power for at least 20 years. That's a very important point. They're experienced. They also represent countries with long memories and long histories of conflict. That makes a difference. It's helpful, because I can tell you that if anything, everything that both of those men have done since this tragedy in Ukraine began has been to deliberately limit the fight. We have provoked the Russians repeatedly, and the Russians have steadily refused to take the bait. I'll be frank with you. I'm not worried about Moscow and Beijing. I'm worried about Washington, and here's why. We suffer from a terminal case of overweening arrogance. I think people used to talk about the deutsche Überheblichkeit. You know, this is before World War I as a complaint. Well, that was modest compared with what goes on in Washington. And you hear these people talk about the United States today as though it were 1991. And it isn't. We're not the same country. Our economy is fragile. Our financial system is, in my judgment, in ruins, poised for all sorts of crises. Then the population itself, we're dealing with the influx of millions of people that are not us. You know, you have that in Europe. We have it here. We're trying to sort through this. So we're not a cohesive society or nation as we once were. And in the midst of all of this, everyone seems to think that we are so powerful and so dominant that no one would dare contradict us, and that anything we want to undertake will work, that our weapons, our capabilities are superior. You don't have any reasonable debate in public about the dangers involved. We have completely forgotten war. The last time we had a war that affected Americans was World War II. And remember, the last time we had a really major war that killed a million of us was the Civil War. So you have a different mentality here. It's a combination of arrogance and, I would also say, ignorance. There's no understanding of the Middle East, just as there's no understanding of Eastern Europe. You know, I've said several times, what are we doing in Ukraine? We don't know anything about Ukraine. We don't know anything about Russia. Now, certainly some of us do, but the broader population doesn't. And again, they look at what's happening in Israel and say, well, it's these Arabs again. We just have to help them defeat these people. But it's not that simple. It's a much larger problem. And by the way, there's this perception that everyone there, including Iran and Turkey, are backward. There's no appreciation for the professional competence of the Turkish armed forces, or for that matter, in the Iranian armed forces. These people are, in fact, sophisticated. They have advanced air and space capabilities, advanced missile technology. And particularly the soldiers that serve in the Turkish army, they're ferocious fighters. They're very good soldiers. There's no sense of that. So I think that's the problem, arrogance and ignorance in Washington. And then the feeling that this is Israel's moment to deal decisively with its opponents, to administer this important object lesson. Remember that throughout its history, the Israelis have always felt that if a single Jew in Israel is harmed, you must immediately strike back and crush the source, or Jews will never be safe. Well, here we sit, and we've done that. It hasn't worked very well, and now they think this is the time to strike the final blow. I would rather not see this progress to the point where everyone thinks it's the final blow. I'm sure you understand.
That's extremely interesting what you're saying. I mean, this reminds me in a horrifying way about Serbia, where the Austrians thought, now we have to solve the Serbian problem and the Germans have to help us. And they thought they would solve a local problem. And by solving this problem, which they didn't, they created a huge mess, a First World War. Is something like that probable to happen now in the Middle East, that the unhinged Israelis walk into Gaza thinking together with the Americans, with the West, we are so strong, we can fight this down to the end, we can solve this problem for good, and at the end they reap a much stronger storm from other countries, and even the Russians and the Chinese could say, now is the time to teach the West a lesson, this arrogance has to stop, as they did with the Germans. They want to collectively punish the Americans and the arrogant Westerners, epitomized by the Israeli, and we end up in a third world war. How probable is a scenario like this?
Well, it's not impossible. It's more probable than I would like to admit, and that's exactly what I've worried about. And of course, you know, we're not prepared for that. By the way, in 1914, only 40% of the Imperial German Army had field gray uniforms. So the Germans were not prepared for a major war either. And of course, everybody thought the same thing. You'll all be home by the time the leaves fall. That was, of course, the Kaiser's announcement. You know, the sad truth is man forgets. We forget repeatedly. And what I'm trying to point out is that the American memory is different from the European memory, because our recollections of the past are shaped by fantasy in many cases. You know, we think that we were better than we were, that we think we are greater than we are. And we refuse to accept the possibility that we're simply a great power. We may be strongest in many respects of the great powers, but we're just a great power. There are other great powers. That's a problem. And no politician wants to stand up and tell Americans the truth. They all want to stand up there and say, we're the greatest people in the world. There's nothing. Listen to Biden. He's talking as though it's 1941.
Lindsey Graham.
Yeah, I mean, it's absurd. People are out of touch with reality. And all this World War style rhetoric is, I would say, is falling on a lot of deaf ears. It's back to what I said at the beginning. Most Americans aren't really engaged anyway.
Mm-hmm. This conversation is taking a turn, which is probably too depressing for me to bear. So therefore, I have to desperately find a beam of hope at this point of our discussion. Now, I will offer a beam of hope to you, Colonel McGregor. I've just read in the summer vacation, I read War and Peace by Leo Tolstoy. And Leo Tolstoy offers a very interesting theory. He says, the politicians, the Napoleons of this world, they are highly overestimated. What really matters is the collective will of the people. And you said something very interesting just before. I mean, you say a lot of interesting things, but something particularly interesting was when you said countries like Russia and China, they have a collective memory. And their memory tells them, we went through hell. We went through humiliation. The Chinese were humiliated by the West. The Russians went through the hell of communism. These people, they have had enough. The Germans have had enough of war. Nobody wants this. Only the Americans, as you say, they're probably a bit too self-confident. But couldn't we argue that the collective will of the people, of the individuals, which has to be taken into account by the politicians, goes against the war? And with Tolstoy, we would say that as long as the people do not want war, there won't be a war. So the will of the people is more important than the madness of the politicians. What do you make of that?
I think you're half right. The part that's wrong is the assumption that the leadership in Washington feels compelled to take into account the will of the people. They don't. That's the point. They've been allowed for decades to conduct foreign and defense policy in isolation from much public censure. In other words, no one has stood up and say, wait a minute, look, we were in Vietnam for 10 years until finally people said, that's enough. You had riots in the streets, the draft fell apart. That was 10 years. We're only at the beginning of many of these things. And again, it's back to how many Americans do you need to kill in one day to wake people up? I hear that question all the time. And the politicians love air and naval power because it's sort of sex without responsibility. You know, once you put ground forces down, you're committed, you're accountable. I mean, we can go back to the history of NATO and Helmut Schmidt, who made himself very unpopular at the time, at the end of his tenure, but he said, if the Americans are not on the ground here in Germany with their forces and their missiles, they will not be taken seriously and neither will we. Well, he was right. We're trying to do everything from a distance. If that distance shrinks and we begin to do things on the ground and Americans are killed, people will start to wake up and say, what are we doing? But thus far, that hasn't happened. And of course, the press is very helpful because it doesn't report the truth. It doesn't tell the truth about the American losses that do occur. It's a huge problem. We've seldom had this in our history, but it's a new dimension of an old problem, which is most people most of the time don't pay attention to what happens overseas. They're much more worried about what's going on in St. Louis, Seattle, and other places, and their income and inflation and accessibility to transportation, cars, gasoline. These things are important. What happens overseas? Well, you know, that's overseas. And I don't care much about that as long as I'm fine.
And this cognitive dissonance is very dangerous at the moment, because the Americans, who are a crucial power, of course, in this whole situation, the Americans don't feel the conflict as they did during the Vietnam War, where they had these demonstrations. So do I understand you correctly? Should we actually advocate for a new peace movement in the West? Should the people go on the streets and say to the leaders, to the collective West, or however you want to call it, stop this stupid policy of overbearing arrogance? Should the people make themselves heard in these isolated, how do you call that, echelons of power?
Well, you could try, but the problem is, in the United States right now, most of that would be regarded, as it was certainly for the first 5 years or so in Vietnam, as evidence for treason, of being unpatriotic and quote-unquote unsupportive of the troops. You know, in my own family, when I was growing up in the 60s, and I was a teenager, my maternal grandfather had been in World War I and World War II. In World War I, he was in the Army, and he was a ferocious opponent of Franklin Roosevelt. He hated Woodrow Wilson, and whenever the topic of war would come up, he would, you know, say, these people were catastrophes. We shouldn't have been in any of these wars. My mother would argue with him. She lived through the Second War, and she said, well, we have to be supportive of the troops. And he would say, if you support the troops, bring them home. Well, of course, he was right. He'd been there in 1918. He thought the whole thing was a travesty, should never have happened. He was correct. But, you know, that's a long time ago. And there aren't many of us around right now. You know, I remember as a child, he was explaining to me his great uncle's experience on the battlefield at Gettysburg, where his great uncle lost the lower left portion of his leg below the knee, lying on the battlefield to be picked up by Confederate medics, who then turned him over to Union medics, and he survived. You know, that not many families are like that. And I grew up with all of that. So I always understood what the military was about. And I understood the risks involved. I don't think that's widespread right now in the United States. So there's no easy answer. Now, one last point, though, to bring up about World War I. Remember that the British had almost, by European standards, no army. They had roughly 250,000, of which they could ship 150,000 to France. And that army was almost exterminated in the first few months of the war. I wrote a chapter in my book, Margin of Victory, all about the British Expeditionary Force. And the British foolishly thought that they would win the war in a great sea battle in the North Sea against the German Navy. Stop and think about that.
Which never left the harbor, by the way, the German Navy.
Well, actually, it did. It fought at Jutland. It did, Helgoland. You know, they fought a major battle, and they did very, very well, but they were never large enough to overwhelm or defeat the British blockade. But my point is, there's a similar attitude in the United States, that things can be managed and orchestrated from a distance, from afar, that, you know, putting large numbers of your own people at risk is unnecessary. That's what the British thought. Well, they had 800,000 dead from Britain alone as a result. We don't understand these things. We are as confused and deluded about military power as the British were, because again, we're an island. People don't get it. We're not a continental power.
Mm-hmm.
So all of, you know, this is why I've argued repeatedly since the 90s. You know, I remember having a wonderful conversation with the German chief of staff, a very wonderful man named Struckmann, Dieter Struckmann. And I said, the Europeans have to have their own command and control. They have to take control of their destiny. He agreed. But he said, you know, how do we get people to do it? You know, everyone was essentially punting, as we would say, the ball to us in Washington. Put your future in the hands of the Americans. I think we should be allies. I think we should be supportive of each other. But turning everything over to us, I think, was and is a mistake.
We are both synchronically dressed in black, which adds to the gloomy atmosphere of our discussion. So I cannot let you walk off, Colonel McGregor, without a last attempt to find the silver lining at the horizon. Where is the beam of hope? Where is the source of optimism that you see? Where is this silver lining, the light in the dark tunnel? Do you see one?
I don't see how you remove the current ruling class in Washington from power soon enough to make any difference. That's the problem. I just don't. You'll have more success removing your problem children from power in Europe because, of course, you have a parliamentary system in most cases, the exception, of course, being France. We don't, and we have what we've got until there's another election, I suspect, or there's an implosion of some other kind. Who knows? But the bottom line is that I wish I could give you a more optimistic assessment at this point, but I can't. I have to read the so-called tea leaves as I see them, and that's what I see right now. And I think it's the culmination of all the various influences that I described. And remember that people like me are condemned routinely in the United States for our quote-unquote isolationism. But it was isolationism, if you want to call it that, which it's misleading because we did business with everyone in the world. This is long before the regime of sanctions. And that was our goal. Our goal was, as Washington put it, to be the world's engine of economic prosperity, not to invade other people's countries. We lost our way. World War I was the beginning of that, and we've never regained it. That's the best that I can tell you. Hopefully something will change that. But in the near term, I am not optimistic. Mm-hmm.
So let's rebrand the word isolationism in more positively sounding, leave the people alone from time to time, or try to put, this is how I would interpret your argument. To prevent the Third World War, there have to be voices in politics who start to put pressure on these belligerents and say, okay, let's cool it off, let's cool it down, and this should be the United States of America. But unfortunately, even though your president did utter some words in this direction, but the pressure from the United States at the moment on Israel not to overreact is not there. But this will be the way to stop World War III, to put some flames out, to put pressure on Israel at the moment. Would that be a way to avoid?
Yes, I think if Eisenhower were to be summoned from the grave and restored to the presidency, this would all stop, because he had a very vivid picture of the Second World War. He knew that our limitations were significant. He knew what the American people would and would not tolerate and what they could and could not do. In other words, he had a sense of limitations. Putin has a sense of limitations. Xi has a sense of limitations. We have none. Just listen to Biden. Oh, come on now. We can support two world wars at once. We have a $33 trillion national sovereign debt. We've exported our manufacturing base overseas, not because the Chinese took it, but because we saw benefit from shipping it out and making money in our elite classes. And we've opened our borders and let anybody in, and we've stopped enforcing our laws, and criminality is raging out of control. But we're the greatest nation in the world. There's nothing we can't do. To put it politely, insane. It's foolish nonsense. We need to get a grip on reality. I think we'll end up getting it, but it's going to be a rough road.
Well, Colonel, this brings me to the absurd conclusion that the last hope of the West are Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, the probably last, more reasonable...
You know, we've got to get out of this habit of condemning people who are different from us.
Yeah.
They may be culturally different. They may have a different political system. They may have different values. In fact, most of them do. That doesn't make them wrong, and it doesn't make us right. It doesn't make them bad, and it doesn't make us better. So treating the world with some degree of mutual respect instead of pouring buckets of filth and abuse all over the heads of people that we don't approve of has got to stop. And Europeans have adopted this approach. It needs to go away.
Colonel, thank you very much. And I think I speak for a lot of our viewers when I say probably someday you should consider to enter the political arena again to apply for the American presidency, because some reasonable and also historically grounded knowledge and realism is desperately needed. Many, many thanks for your time. Many thanks for your insight. Always a pleasure and privilege to talk to you.
Sure, thanks very much. All the best.
Thank you. Meine Damen und Herren, wir sind damit am Ende dieser Sendung angelangt. Hochinteressant, und ich finde das immer wieder extrem lehrreich, wenn man mit erfahrenen Leuten jetzt aus dem Militär sprechen kann, die auch eine große historische Erfahrung und ein großes Wissen da mitbringen. One very, very last question. It just pops up in my mind, Colonel. I mean, you have been in combat. You have dedicated your life to the military, but also to the studies of philosophy, of history. Just in a very short point, what is the most important lesson you took out of your military experience in the field? What is the most important thing there?
It takes many years, usually a decade or two, to build an effective military establishment. Victories are won not on the day of battle, but years before, with decisions regarding equipment, most important decisions about how to fight and who should command. Those things are determined long before the war begins. And you have to understand the impact of those decisions and what you can and can't do. That brings us back to this sense of limitations. We tend to think in terms of, you know, well, we'll go over here and fight these people. Why not consider the possibility that if you cannot be certain that you can win, don't fight?
Thank you very much. All the best. And I hope to talk to you again, hopefully on much more optimistic matters. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Roman, ist gut? Ist er jetzt gerade ausgestiegen?